Now, I want to deal with Romans. And so the first question I have to do is to help you understand that there's a radical difference between religion and authentic worship. And that's very crucial. And I want to reflect with you on the Roman road. When I was in high school, I learned most of those texts in the Navigator system. There was some that are called the Roman road. The few verses, that's not the Roman road for me. The Roman road is the way in which we explain salvation and living for Christ. So I want to try to help you with that. It is a map that you can follow through Romans to understand salvation. Now, the theme of Romans is spelled out in the early first chapter. The theme of Romans is spelled out in Romans 1, 16 and 17. I am not ashamed of the gospel. It is the power of God to salvation to everyone who believes, to the Jew first and also to the Greek. And then it goes on to talk about, it began in faith and it goes on into faith. There's two prepositions in Greek. One is ek and the other is eis. The one is out of and the other is into, which means from the beginning to the end, life is a life of faith. You see, this the RSV, for faith, through faith, and so on, it has no meaning at all. But what the Greek is really saying, it begins in faith and it ends in faith. So the whole of life is a life of faith. And part of our problem, especially in Baptist circles and evangelical circles, is that we think about faith being related to how you begin. And we focus on the beginning of the Christian life. And many times we don't spend any time on living the Christian life. Romans is about living the Christian life. And more is written about living the Christian life than becoming a Christian. But I'll call about that a little later. So, and then the next thing you need to know is that from faith to faith, as it is written, the just shall live by faith, is the way most translations make it. But the most important thing to understand is the last word. The last word in a Greek sentence is always the most important. And the last word in the Greek sentence is the word live. This is important. So, the just by faith shall live. You got it? Don't forget that. We're talking about living in faith. So, what he wants us to understand is that if there are sections in Romans that try to spell out this process. And the first section has to do with the plight of humanity. And the plight of humanity has to do with first the Gentiles and then the Jews. And the important thing to understand, if you'll take your text, because it's the only way you can see it, I want you to see something here. You'll turn to Romans chapter 1 and look at the text. It's very important, because when you understand this, you understand Hellenistic psychology. And what I'm going to try to do for you is to try to spell out various aspects of psychology, too. Let me say it this way. When I was in Princeton, I was studying psychology, and I was amazed that Paul is even better at understanding the plight of humanity than Jung and Freud. Now that's to make a very, very clear statement. And that, to me, is a signal that you ought to understand. So, oh, I'm sorry. All right, so let's look at something here. If you look at verse 24, whoops, at verse 24, you'll see, let's start with verse 18. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and wickedness of humans. By their wickedness, they suppress the truth. Now that means very clearly that we may know the truth, but that doesn't mean that we're going to do it. And we take a positive statement that we're going to live with the truth, and then we turn it around and we suppress it. And so they are without excuse, for though they knew God, they did not honor God or give him thanks. So they don't bless God, but they change the glory of God into of the immortal God into images of mortal humans, birds, animals, and so on. Well, you know that paganism made very clearly gods in the images of the crocodiles and everything else. But if you notice verse 24, God gave them up. Verse 26, God gave them up. Verse 28, God gave them up. Now what is God doing? God is doing something very interesting. The Hellenistic psychology, you'll often hear the Hellenistic psychology is built on a bifurcation of the human being. And normally it comes to body and soul. But the most sophisticated Hellenistic psychology is a tripartite psychology. The naos is the mind. The cardia is the heart. And the pathos is the passions. Okay? So when you understand this, it's very important. The mind in the minds of the Greeks does not get contaminated. The heart, well, it might, but that's the seat of the will. And the pathos is your passion. Now, I've divided this very importantly into three sections. The top section is the mind, which is the head. This middle section relates to above the stomach. Above the stomach is the heart, which is the seat of the will. And this fits pretty much with your Jewish thinking, too. The heart is the will. But the passions, let me put it this way. The passions is we eat too much, we drink too much, we have too much sex. You got it? That's all the lower part of your body. So that's the way they thought. Well, Paul does something very interestingly. Paul does this. He starts at the center. The center, which is the center of the will. And he says, God delivers your will first to what you want to do. If you want to do something, you're going to very clearly do what you want to do. In other words, when you want to do something, you'll do it, no matter what happens. The next thing is he delivers the passions. Because we eat too much, we drink too much. We've already willed to eat too much. And we've already willed to have too much sex. And we've already willed to drink too much. So when that happens, then your mind gets distorted. So he's saying, you start with a will, you do what you want to do, and then your mind tries to justify that. You see? This is the way Paul is thinking. That's why he has stages of deliverance. And the word, very interestingly, for deliverance here is paradidomi, which is the same sense of the idea of that Judas delivered Jesus. You got it, the same word. Okay, now what we have to understand is that the Hellenists would say, oh, no. The mind will not get distorted. But Paul says something very differently. He says the mind itself gets distorted. And then what happens? At the end of that text, it lists all the things that you do wrong. You know, when you read this, this is like all the vices. We're full of, filled with all manner of wickedness, evil, covetousness, malice, envy, murder, strife, deceit, malignity, gossiping, slandering, and haters of God, insolent, haughty. Well, on and goes. But what is important is this. Verse 32. Though they know God's decree that those who do such things deserve to die, they not only do them, but they conspire with others to practice them. In other words, as long as I can get somebody else to join me, then I feel okay. So always the justification will want somebody else to be with me. This is the important understanding. And for a number of people in classes, I've already taught you, so you may have heard this before. But this is very important to understand what Paul is saying. You got it? Okay. Yeah, the Hellenists, the pagans, are distorted. That's what he's saying. And the Jew is looking on and saying about this, oh, they're bad. Right? The Jews are saying they're bad. That's what they always said about the Hellenists. They're terrible. They'll never make it into heaven or anything else. They're totally bad. We judge people. And what does Paul say in chapter 2? You guys who judge, you actually do the same stuff. Now, then I want you to understand the Jewish psychology. So I'm going to give you Jewish psychology now. Jewish psychology has two yetzers. You got to know this. Two yetzers. Tov. That's yetzer. That's the one to be good and the one to be evil. Okay, so you've got two inclinations. You can do either or. And the Jewish thinking process is that you can either do good or bad, and you can make the decision. Got it? You can make the decision. And Paul says, do you know what Paul says? Nope. That's not going to work. You know why? Because you know what to do and you don't do it. So you judge other people on the basis of what you know, and because you know something, you think you're going to do it. And Paul says that's not what happens. You see, because you know something doesn't mean you're going to do it. In fact, he says, because you know it, you're in more trouble. You can just hear the Jews responding to him, can't you? Oh, we know that. And Paul says, and you don't do it. And then he gives a whole list at the beginning of chapter 3 on how bad you are. He's telling the Jews how bad they are because the Bible tells them they're. And we've got a flora legium text that follows in the beginning of chapter 3. Do you understand what a flora legium text is? It's a whole series of texts chosen from the Old Testament that are put together to prove something. So this is the process of proving something. Am I clear? Okay, so now what happens? Do you know what Romans 3:23 is? All have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. You see where you can't come to? None of you are righteous. You're in problems. You think you're righteous, but you're not. Okay. So the Yetzers don't help you. In fact, what do? They judge you. To the Jew first and also to the Greek. You see what he's doing? That's the way he thinks. He wants to make sure that everybody's included. I'm sure that the Jews, when they first read chapter 1 of Romans, they were saying, yeah, you're right. Paul said, just wait. So, there's no real difference between the Jews and the Greeks. It ends up, all have sinned and shined. So that means that God has to act, because we can't act on our own. And because we're unable to obey, God has to provide a way. And he provides a way in the gift of Jesus. That's Paul's argument. The free gift of God in Jesus is for both Jews and Greeks. That means, as Paul says, there's no room in the church for boasting. See, now, nobody can look at anybody else and say, I'm better than you. Do we have any trouble like that? I don't want to sit next to that guy. This is quite typical. So we have to face reality. What Paul is trying to do in this chapter is to help people face reality. So the next question is the law bad? Well, is the law bad? You remember Luther? He divided between law and grace, didn't he? That is incorrect. Law is part of grace. Now, can you tell me why I have said that?
Because you're Jewish.
Pardon?
Because you're Jewish.
No.
If it wasn't for the law, you have no sense of your need for grace. And you don't ask forgiveness until you've been found guilty.
Well, that's correct. In other words, law is a standard that God gives to us to help us know that we are not obedient. You see, this is God's standard. So law is a way of telling us that God has standards. And that means that law is an aspect of grace. So when you come to start thinking, please don't separate law and grace. That's not the way to do it. That's incorrect. So, you know, I like Luther. In fact, I read him. I like his bombastic style. You know, that's the one thing. That really goes for me, you know. Calvin, let me give you an illustration of how I think. Calvin's a great logician. And I like logicians. But Have any of you read Walter Scott's dialogue between the Saracen and King Richard, the Lionheart? That's a long time ago. Yeah. Anyway, it's a wonderful story. It's a wonderful story. These two are facing each other just before battle and so on like that. And the Saracen says, I've heard that you can swing this, your mighty sword and so on like that. And I'd like to see an example of this. And Richard the Lionheart said, "Oh, great, I'll do it." And he takes his sword and go bang and splits stuff in half. Wow. And Richard the Lionheart says to the Saracen, he said, "I've heard that you've got a very sharp sword, and I'd like to see a demonstration of that." He says, "Okay." So he sticks out his sword, his scimitar, and he sticks it out and he throws a piece of wool in the air and it comes down, floats on, and splits in half. The wool splits in half. But when I think of Calvin, I think of Calvin as somebody who takes a sword across somebody's neck like that, and the neck stays there, but you can't stick your tongue out anymore. Whereas Richard the Lionheart takes his axe and goes boom, and you're split. You see, both of them kill. But they're different ways. And I think that's the way, when you read Calvin, you want to read him one way. When you read Luther, you read him another way. Luther is bombastic. Calvin is very, very sharp. The Western mindset usually likes Calvin better than Luther. I like Luther. Okay. Well, all right. This is what I'm trying to help you understand. Paul has just bombed both the Jew and the Greek. He's taken care of that, and he says to them, "We need the standards of the law." The divine solution, however, is section 2 of Romans, and it starts really at 3:21, and it goes on through 4. So what's happening here is that we proclaim the critical significance of Jesus. And Jesus is absolutely crucial to salvation. But what we need to do is, when we're reading this part, this is only the first stage of salvation. We are justified by faith. Luther was correct, but he was more correct when he said even that when we are justified, that does not mean that we are made righteous. We are declared righteous. I had a big argument in our translation of the New Living Translation, and all the other guys said, yeah, they wanted that we're made righteous. I said, no, 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 you're never made righteous. You're always declared righteous, treated like righteous. You never become righteous until you enter the kingdom of God. This is where I think we get wrong. And that has led to all kinds of misunderstanding, especially among evangelicals, who think all they have to do is walk down the aisle and it's all done. It's not all done when you walk down the aisle and say yes to Jesus. That's the beginning of the process. And this is very crucial. It's very crucial. We are still sinners when we are recipients of grace. Can we sin after we've become a Christian? Well, you know the answer, don't you?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, John says if we do not sin, we deceive ourselves and the truth isn't in us. I mean, that's very clear. Now, what's happening is there's a big misunderstanding about the Apostle Paul and his teaching, and I want to try to correct that. Why is Abraham in this story? Abraham is there as a model. Was Abraham perfect? Absolutely not. Abraham is not perfect. And yet he's a model, right? I mean, I don't think that Abraham is the kind of guy that I would always like. You remember when he went into Egypt? When he went into Egypt, he says to Pharaoh's guys, she's my sister. I'm saying, that's a fink. You know, this guy, he's trying to save his own skin. And then Pharaoh says, I just got a dream and I found out that she must be your wife and not. Now get out of here. And he didn't do it just once, he did it twice. I mean, what kind of guy is that? I want you to understand something. The hero of the Bible is not Abraham or David. Think about David or Daniel or anybody else. The hero of the Bible is God. That's who the hero of the Bible is. And sometimes we get that mixed up. So we are accepted as righteous by Jesus. That's the meaning of believing in Paul. We're not perfect. We trust God. And up to this point, most Christians will agree with me. Because they basically think about salvation as justification. But there's much more than that. The first stage is that Christ was put to death for our sins and he was raised for our justification. Now, the third section of this Book of Romans starts with chapter 5. And here's where it's very important. This is living the new life. And this section is very crucial to our understanding of Romans. Please don't misunderstand this. So, let me give you an illustration. The Bailey brothers, there's a kind of a tradition about them. The two Baileys, they were Scottish theologians. And they were walking down the street and they were confronted by a Salvation Army officer who said to them, brothers, are you saved? And one of the Bailey brothers says to the Salvation Army officer, yes, partly and no. What? Says the Salvation Army. Yes, I am justified. Partly I am sanctified, and no, I am not glorified. Do you understand what I just said?
Yes.
There's a process going on here. And so if you ask me, am I saved? The part of the answer is yes. The other part of the answer is no, though I'm getting pretty close. And the middle part of the answer is, I'm in the process. So, the question about being saved is a very technical question, which is not very technical for most people. They've got it all solved when you become a Christian. But the whole process of becoming a Christian is something far bigger than that. And that's where the real question comes. So, I will continue. I want you to watch on how this follows. We are accepted by God through faith, and that leads to peace. That's chapter 5, verse 1. And that's the significance of Paul, because Paul loves triads. And you're going to discover that in chapter 5, the first part of chapter 5, you're going to get the triads. And you know what the triads are? They have to do with something. Oh, tell me, how does 1 Corinthians 13 end?
Faith, hope, and love.
And now abideth faith, hope, love. Now, a triad in Paul, you have to understand this. The triad in Paul, the last element will tell you what he's going to talk about. Did you know that? So if the last element in Paul is love, what is he going to talk about? He's going to talk about living the Christian life in love. Got it? If he's talking about justification, he's talking about becoming a Christian. If he's talking about hope, he's talking about the end of life. Did you know that that triad is different in different books? The order in the Thessalonian letters and in Colossians is faith, love, and hope. So you have to kind of be understanding the triad in order to understand what's in the book. So that if you're going to talk about Colossians, you're going to talk about, he's talking about getting to the end. If you're going to talk about living the life, like in Corinthians, he's going to talk about love being at the end of it. Got it? Okay, here in chapter 5, the order is faith, hope, and love. Now, he doesn't miss them. He doesn't miss any of the elements. He's got all the elements there, but he's going to deal with the way you live for Christ. Do we want to go back to the old way? No. So now he's got to keep them going the other way. So, I need to talk to you about another thing, about why we end up with getting wrong perspectives on salvation. You know what it is? It's we thingify grace, we thingify faith, and we thingify salvation. Let me show you. I give my faith to Jesus. Jesus says thank you and puts it in his pocket. Jesus gives me back grace and I put it in my safety deposit box. And then what I do, not only that, I get a statement on when I was baptized and I put that in my safety deposit for sure. Because now I'm saved. You got it? We thingify faith and grace and salvation. But faith is not a thing. Faith is what I give to God as myself. And what does God give me? His self. And then I've got something that I've received, and I have salvation. But salvation is not a thing. It is a relationship. Do you see how that changes everything? When you change it into a relationship, it's not a thing anymore. I have a relationship with Jesus. So I don't have anything that I can put in the safety deposit box. I've got a relationship with Jesus. Am I living with Jesus? That's a question. You see, as long as you thingify salvation, you got something that they can't take away from you. Do you see why we've got problems? Because of our thingification, then we have problems because now we are in an argument about whether we can lose it. Can you lose salvation? You can lose a thing. What about a relationship? Because we have completely misunderstood the phenomenon called salvation, we are in big trouble with our theology. Now, what I'm really concerned about, I'm really concerned about us not pretending that we got something that we don't have. Our people know they sin. They go up and down. And we know we go up and down with God. I don't want us to give false kinds of ideas. Are you consistent? Do you know, I don't even need to ask you that question. I already know it. You are not consistent, because if you were consistent, you wouldn't even need to be here. I know it all. And that's why a lot of people don't come to our churches. We've got a false concept of what salvation is. They just don't want, they know that we're phony. They know we're phony, and it's about time we start admitting our phoniness. So, walking is not something. And you remember, right here is where Paul comes in with walking. We've now reached that conclusion. Walk in newness of life. To walk is again the strategic idea of halakha. And it's not halakha. Remember the rabbis. And we do the same thing. I think what has happened is we've developed a static idea of salvation. So that we walk into it, we got it now, I've got it in my pocket, I'm saved. And I got to get the rest of you saved and get you in my pocket too. You do that, fine. You may be able to convince some people. But walking with God is the way of sanctification. Now that's very crucial, and the end of that is what? Romans 6. Is eternal life. You know, I want to know what eternal life is. It's when you get there. Are you absolutely certain you're going to get there? Do you understand that worship is part of the process of sanctification?
Yes.
That's what we're talking about, of holy living. So what happens if you've got a false kind of worship? You think you're getting there? Well, You see, what I'm trying to tell you is style of worship, praying, etc., is not worship. Worship is relating to God. Now, they can be helpful, but you got to be careful about what worship is. See, we love to get in arguments over worship aspects. The real question is, are you worshiping God? Are you walking with God? Because when you're walking with God, you're in the process. See, that's exactly what I've tried, why I wrote my book on worship in the New Testament, and why I agree totally with Bob Weber. When we two of us started to talk, we were right. Worship is a verb. Member? That book is probably the best one that Bob Weber wrote, because it finally sets out what it is. See, when I read that book, I said to Bob, he was teaching for me, I said to Bob, this is where we are, Bob, we can make it. Finally, people will understand, maybe, what worship is. But as long as we keep turning worship into something, we're not going to get any place. So that's why I'm making this point for you, because that's what Romans is about. You remember we're kind of going to come to chapter 12, and guess what? It's about worship. Okay?